the Bishop of Winchester will buy you one himself, if you'll show your face on the day.
Stephen, will he?
I swear it. He relishes the thought of going back to London asking Gardiner for £10. Or the guildsman will make a collection, if you like, for a new hat and a doublet as well. And how are you to appear? Margaret speaks gently, as if she's been asked to mind two children for the afternoon. They are making something for me. I leave it to others. If I only avoid exciting mirth, it will be enough. Anne has said, you shall not dress like a lawyer on my coronation day. She has called out to Jane Rochford, taking notes like a clerk. Thomas must go into crimson. Mistress Roper, he says, are you not yourself curious to see the Queen crowned? Her father cuts in, talking over her.
It is a day of shame for the women of England. One can hear them say on the streets when the Emperor comes, wives shall have their rights again.
Father, I am sure they take care not to say that in Master Cromwell's hearing. He sighs. It's not much to know that all the merry young whores are on your side, all the kept women and the runaway daughters. Though now Anne is married, she sets herself up for an example. Already she has slapped Mary Shelton, Lady Carey tells him, for writing a riddle in her prayer book, and it was not even an indecent one. The Queen sits very erect these days, child stirring in her belly, needlework in hand, and when Norris and Weston and their gentlemen friends come swarming into her apartments, she looks at them when they lay compliments at her feet, as if they were strewing her hem with spiders. Unless you approach her with the Bible text in your mouth, better not approach her at all. He says, has the maid been up to see you again, the prophetess?
She has, Meg says,
but we would not receive her. I believe she has been to see Lady Exeter at her invitation.
Lady Exeter is a foolish and ambitious woman, Moore says.
I understand the maid told her that she would be Queen of England.
I repeat my comment.
Do you believe in her visions? Their holy nature, that is?
No, I think she's an impostor. She does it for attention.
Just that?
You don't know what young women will do. I have a house full of daughters.
He pauses. You are blessed.
Meg glances up. She recalls his losses, though she never heard Anne Cromwell demand, why should Mistress Moore have the preeminence? She says,
there were holy maids before this, one at Ipswich, only a little girl of 12. She was of good family, and they say she did miracles, and she got nothing out of it, no personal profit, and she died young.
But then there was the Maid of Leinster, Moore says with gloomy relish. They say she is a whore at Calais now, and laughs with her clients after supper at all the tricks she worked on the believing people.
So he does not like holy maids. But Bishop Fisher does. He has seen her often. He has dealings with her. As if taking the words out of his mouth, Moore says,
of course, Fisher, he has his own views.
Fisher believes she has raised the dead. Moore lifts an eyebrow, but only for so long as it took the corpse to make his confession and get absolution. Then he fell down and died again. Moore smiles.
That sort of miracle.
Perhaps she's a witch, Meg says. Do you think so? There are witches in the scriptures. I could cite you.
Please don't.
Moore says,
Meg, did I show you where I put the letter?
She rises, marking with a thread her place in the Greek text.
I have written to this maid, Barton. Dame Elizabeth, we must call her, now she is a professed nun. I have advised her to leave the realm in tranquillity, to cease to trouble the king with her prophecies, to avoid the company of great men and women, to listen to her spiritual advisers, and in short, to stay at home and say her prayers.
As we all should, Sir Thomas, following your example.
He nods vigorously.
Amen. And I suppose you kept a copy?
Get it, Meg, otherwise he may never leave.
Moore gives his daughter some rapid instructions, but he is satisfied that he is not ordering her to fabricate such a letter on the spot.
I would leave, he says, in time, but I'm not going to miss the coronation. I've got my new clothes to wear. Will you not come and bear us company? You'll be company for each other in hell.
This is what you forget, this vehemence. His ability to make his twisted jokes but not take them.
The Queen looks well, he says. Your Queen, I mean, not mine. She seems very comfortable at Ant Hill. But you know that, of course.
Moore says, unblinking, I have no correspondence with the Princess Dowager.
Good, he says, because I am watching two friars who have been carrying her letters abroad. I am beginning to think that whole order of the Franciscans is working against the king. If I take them, and if I cannot persuade them, and you know I am very persuasive into confirming my suspicion, I may have to hang them up by their wrists and start a sort of contest between them as to which one will emerge first into better sense. Of course, my own inclination would be to take them home, feed them, and ply them with strong drink. But then, Sir Thomas, I have always looked up to you, and you have been my master in these proceedings.
He has to say it all before Margaret Roper comes back. He wraps his fingers on the table to make Moore sit up and pay attention.
John Frith, he says, ask to see Henry. He will welcome you like a lost child. Talk to him, and ask him to meet Frith face to face. I'm not asking you to agree with John. You think he's a heretic. Perhaps he is a heretic. I'm asking you to concede just this, and to tell it to the king, that Frith is a pure soul. He's a fine scholar, so let him live. If his doctrine is false and yours is true, you can talk him back to you. You are an eloquent man. You are the great persuader of our age. Not me. Talk him back to Rome if you can. But if he dies, you will never know, will you? If you could have won his soul.
Margaret's footstep.
Is this it, Father? Give it to him. There are copies of the copy, I suppose.
You would expect us, the girl says, to take all reasonable care.
Your father and I were discussing monks and friars. How can they be good subjects of the king if they owe their allegiance to the heads of their orders, who are abroad in other countries, and who are themselves perhaps subjects of the King of France or the Emperor?
I suppose they are still Englishmen.
I meet few who behave as such. Your father will enlarge on what I say.
He bows to her. He takes Moore's hand, holding its shifting sinews in his own palm. Scars vanish. It is surprising how they do. And now his own hand is white, a gentleman's hand, flesh running easily over the joints. Then once he thought the burn marks, the stripes that any smith picks up in the course of business would never fade.
He goes home. Helen Barr meets him. I've been fishing, he says, at Chelsea.
Catch more?
Not today.
Your robes came?
Yes.
Crimson.
Dear God, he laughs. Helen, she looks at him. She seems to be waiting. I haven't found your husband.
Her hands are plunged into the pocket of her apron. She shifts them, as if she were holding something. He sees that one of her hands is clutching the other.
So you suppose he is dead?
It would be reasonable to think so. I have spoken with the man who saw him go into the river. He seems a good witness.
So I could marry again, if anybody wanted me.
Helen's eyes rest on his face. She says nothing, just stands. The moment seems to last a long time. Then,
what happened to our picture? The one with the man holding his heart shaped like a book. What do I mean, his book shaped like a heart?
I gave it to a Genovese.
Why?
I needed to pay for an archbishop.
She moves, reluctant, slow. She drags her eyes from his face.
Hans is here. He's been waiting for you. He is angry. He says time is money.
I'll make it up to him.
Hans is taking time off from his preparations for the coronation. He's building a living model of Mount Parnassus on Gracechurch Street. And today, he has to put the nine muses through their paces, so he doesn't like being kept waiting by Thomas Cromwell. He's banging around in the next room. It seems he's moving the furniture. They take Frith to the Archbishop's palace at Croydon to be examined by Cranmer. The new Archbishop could have seen him at Lambeth, but the way to Croydon is longer and lies through the woods. In the depth of these woods, they say to him, "It will be a bad day for us if you were to give us the slip. For see how thick the trees are on the Wandsworth side. You could hide an army in there. We could spend 2 days searching there, more. And if you'd gone east, to Kent and the river, you'd be clear away before we got around to that side." But Frith knows his road. He's going towards his death. They stand on the path, whistling, talking about the weather. One pisses leisurely against a tree. One follows the flight of a jay through the branches. But when they turn back, Frith is waiting, placid, for his journey to resume. 4 days. 50 barges in procession, furnished by the city livery companies, 2 hours from the city to Blackwall, their rigging hung with bells and flags, a light but brisk breeze as order from God in his prayers. Reverse order, anchor at the steps of Greenwich Palace, collect incoming queen in her own barge, Catherine's old one, rebadged, 24 oars. Next, her women, her guard, all the ornaments of the king's court, all those proud and noble souls who swore they'd sabotage the event. Boats packed with musicians, 300 craft afloat, banners and pennants flying, the music ringing bank to bank, and each bank lined with Londoners. Downstream of the tide, led by an aquatic dragon spitting fire, and accompanied by wild men throwing fireworks, sea-going ships discharge their ordnance in salute. By the time they reach the tower, the sun is out. It looks as if the Thames is ablaze. Henry is waiting to greet Anne as she lands. He kisses her without formality, scooping back her gown, pinning it at her sides to show her belly to England. Next, Henry makes knights, a shoal of Howards and Boleyns, their friends and followers. Anne rests. Uncle Norfolk is missing the show. Henry has sent him to King Francis to reaffirm the most cordial alliance between our two kingdoms. He is Earl Marshal and should be in charge of the coronation, but there is another Howard to step in as his deputy, and besides, he, Thomas Cromwell, is running everything, including the weather. He has conferred with Arthur Lord Lyle, who will preside at the coronation banquet. Arthur Plantagenet, a gentle relic of a former age. He is to go to Calais, directly this is over, to replace Lord Berners as governor, and he, Cromwell, must brief him before he goes. Lyle has a long, bony Plantagenet face, and he is tall like his father, King Edward, who no doubt had many bastards, but none so distinguished as this elderly man, bending his creaky knee in obeisance before Boleyn's daughter. His wife, Honor, his second wife, is 20 years his junior, small and delicate, a toy wife. She wears tawny silk, coral bracelets with gold hearts, and an expression of vigilant dissatisfaction bordering on the peevish. She looks him up and down.
"I suppose you are Cromwell."
If a man spoke to you in that tone, you'd invite him to step outside and ask someone to hold your coat. Day 2. Bringing Anne to Westminster. He is up before first light, watching from the battlements as thin clouds disperse over the Bermondsey bank, and an early chill as clear as water is replaced by a steady golden heat. Her procession is led by the retinue of the French ambassador. The judges in scarlet follow, the knights of the Bath in blue violet of antique cut, then the bishops, Lord Chancellor, Audley and his retinue, the great lords in crimson velvet. 16 knights carry Anne in a white litter, hung with silver bells which ring at each step, at each breath. The queen is in white, her body shimmering in its strange skin, her face held in a conscious solemn smile, her hair loose beneath a circle of gems. After her, ladies on palfreys trapped with white velvet, and ancient dowagers in their chariots, their faces acidulated. At every turn on the route, there are pageants and living statues, recitations of her virtue and gifts of gold from city coffers, her white falcon emblem crowned and entwined with roses, and blossom mashed and minced under the treading feet of the stout 16, so scent rises like smoke. The route is hung with tapestries and banners, and at his orders the ground beneath the horse's hooves is gravel to prevent slipping, and the crowds restrained behind rails in case of riots and crush. Every law officer London can muster is among the crowd, because he is determined that in time to come, when this is remembered and told to those who were not here, no one is going to say, "Oh, Queen Anne's coronation, that was the day I got my pocket picked." Fenchurch Street, Leadenhall, Cheap, Paul's Churchyard, Fleet, Temple Bar, Westminster Hall. So many fountains flowing with wine that it's hard to find one flowing with water. And looking down on them, the other Londoners, those monsters who live in the air, the city's uncounted population of stone men and women and beasts, the things that are neither human nor beasts, fanged rabbits and flying hares, four-legged birds and pinioned snakes, imps with bulging eyes and duck's bills, men who are wreathed in leaves or have the heads of goats or rams, creatures with knotted coils and leather wings, with hairy ears and cloven feet, horned and roaring, feathered and scaled, some laughing, some singing, some pulling back their lips to show their teeth, lions and friars, donkeys and geese, devils with children crammed into their maws, all chewed up except for their helpless paddling feet, limestone or leaden, metalled or marbled, shrieking and sniggering above the populace, hooting and gurning and dry-heaving from buttresses, walls and roofs. That night, the king permitting, he goes back to Austin Friars. He visits his neighbour Chapuis, who has secluded himself from the events of the day, bolting his shutters and stuffing his ears against the fanfares, the ceremonial cannon fire. He goes in a small satirical procession led by Thurston, taking the ambassador's sweetmeats to ease his sulks, and some fine Italian wine sent to him by the Duke of Suffolk. Chapuis greets him without a smile.
"Well, you have succeeded where the cardinal failed. Henry has what he wants at last. I say to my master, who is capable of looking at these things impartially, it is a pity, from Henry's point of view, that he did not take up Cromwell years ago. His affairs would have gone on much better."
He is about to say, "The cardinal taught me everything," but Chapuis talks over him.
"When the cardinal came to a closed door, he would flatter it. Oh, beautiful, yielding door. Then he would try tricking it open. And you are just the same, just the same."
He pours himself some of the Duke's present.
"But in the last resort, you just kick it in."
The wine is one of those big, noble wines that Brandon favours, and Chapuis drinks appreciatively and says, "I don't understand it. Nothing do I understand in this benighted country. Is Cranmer Pope now? Or is Henry Pope? Perhaps you are Pope. My men, who were among the press today, say they heard few voices raised for the concubine, and plenty who called upon God to bless Catherine, the rightful queen. Did they? I don't know what city they were in." Chapuis sniffs. They may well wonder. These days it is nothing but Frenchmen about the king, and she, Boleyn, she is half French herself, and wholly bought by them. Her entire family are in the pocket of Francis. But you, Thomas, you are not taken in by these Frenchmen, are you? He reassures him, "My dear friend, not for one instant." Chapuis weeps. It's unlike him. All credit to the noble wine.
"I have failed my master, the Emperor. I have failed Catherine."
"Never mind." He thinks, tomorrow is another battle, tomorrow is another world. He's at the abbey by dawn. The procession is forming up by six. Henry will watch the coronation from a box screened by a lattice, sequestered in the painted stonework. When he puts his head in about 8 o'clock, the king is already sitting expectantly on a velvet cushion, and a kneeling servant is unpacking his breakfast. "The French ambassador will be joining me," Henry says, and he meets that gentleman as he's hurrying away.
One, yes, you have been painted, Maître Cramwell. I, too, have been painted. You have seen the result?
Not yet. Hans is so occupied. Even on this fine morning, here beneath fan vaulting, the ambassador looks blue-tinged. Well, he says, it appears that with the coronation of this queen, our two nations have reached the state of perfect amity. How to improve on perfection? I ask you, monsieur. The ambassador bows.
Downhill from here?
Let's try, you know, to maintain a state of mutual usefulness when our sovereigns are once again snapping at each other.
Another Calais meeting?
Perhaps in a year.
No sooner?
I will not put my king on the high seas for no cause.
We'll talk, Cramwell.
Flat palm, the ambassador taps him on the chest, over the heart. Anne's procession forms up at 9. She is mantled in purple velvet, edged in ermine. She has 700 yards to walk, on the blue cloth that stretches to the altar, and her face is entranced. Far behind her, the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, supporting her train, nearer, holding up the hem of her long robe, the Bishop of Winchester at one side, the Bishop of London at the other. Both of them, Gardiner and Stokesley, were king's men in the matter of the divorce. But now they look as if they wish they were far distant from the living object of his remarriage, who has a fine sheen of sweat on her high forehead, and whose compressed lips, by the time she reaches the altar, seem to have vanished into her face. Who says two bishops should hold up her hem? It's all written down in a great book, so old that one hardly dare touch it, breathe on it. Lyle seems to know it by heart. Perhaps it should be copied and printed, he thinks. He makes a mental note, and then concentrates his will on Anne. Anne not to stumble, as she folds herself towards the ground, to lie face down in prayer before the altar, her attendant stepping forward to support her for the crucial 12 inches before belly hits sacred pavement. He finds himself praying. This child, his half-formed heart now beating against the stone floor, let him be sanctified by this moment, and let him be like his father's father, like his Tudor uncles. Let him be hard, alert, watchful of opportunity, wringing use from the smallest turn of fortune. If Henry lives 20 years, Henry who is Wolsey's creation, and then leaves this child to succeed him, I can build my own prince, to the glorification of God and the Commonwealth of England, because I will not be too old. Look at Norfolk. Already he is 60. His father was 70 when he fought at Flodden. And I shall not be like Henry Wyatt and say, now I am retiring from affairs. Because what is there but affairs? Anne, shaky, is back on her feet. Cranmer, in a dense cloud of incense, is pressing into her hand the scepter, the rod of ivory, and resting the crown of St. Edward briefly on her head, before changing for a lighter and more bearable crown. A prestidigitation, his hands as supple as if he'd been shuffling crowns all his life. The prelate looks mildly excited, as if someone had offered him a cup of warm milk. Anointed, Anna withdraws, incense billowing around her, swallowed into its murk. Anna Regina, to a bedchamber provided for her, to prepare for the feast in Westminster Hall. He pushes unceremoniously through the dignitaries, all you who said you would not be here, and catches sight of Charles Brandon, Constable of England, mounted on his white horse, and ready to ride into the hall among them. He is a huge, blazing presence, from which he withdraws his sight. Charles, he thinks, will not outlive me either. Back into the dimness towards Henry. Only one thing checks him, the sight, whisking around a corner, of the hem of a scarlet robe. No doubt it is one of the judges, escaped from his procession. The Venetian ambassador is blocking the entrance to Henry's box, but the king waves him aside and says, Cromwell, did not my wife look well? Did she not look beautiful? Will you go and see her and give her... He looks around for some likely present, then wrenches a diamond from his knuckle. Will you give her this?
He kisses the ring. And this, too. I shall hope to convey the sentiment, he says, and sighs, as if he were Cranmer. The king laughs. His face is alight. This is my best, he says. This is my best day.
Until their birth, Majesty, says the Venetian, bowing. It is Mary Howard, Norfolk's little daughter, who opens the door to him.
No, you most certainly cannot come in, she says. Utterly not. The Queen is undressed.
Richmond is right, he thinks. She has no breasts at all.
Still, for 14. I'll charm this small Howard, he thinks. So he stands spinning words around her, complimenting her gown and her jewels, till he hears a voice from within, muffled like a voice from a tomb. And Mary Howard jumps and says, oh, all right. If she says so, you can see her.
The bed curtains are drawn closed. He pulls them back. Anne is lying in her shift. She looks flat as a ghost, except for the shocking mound of her six-month child. In her ceremonial robes, her condition had hardly showed, and only that sacred instant as she lay belly down to stone had connected him to her body, which now lies stretched out like a sacrifice, her breasts puffy beneath the linen, her swollen feet bare.
"Mother of God," she says, "can you not leave Howard women alone? For an ugly man you are very sure of yourself. Let me look at you."
She bobs her head up.
"Is that crimson? It's a very black crimson. Did you go against my orders?"
"Your cousin Francis Bryan says I look like a travelling bruise."
"A contusion on the body politic."
Jane Rochford laughs.
"Can you do this?" he asks, almost doubting, almost tender. "You are exhausted."
"Oh, I think she will bear up."
There is no sisterly pride in Mary's voice.
"She was born for this, was she not?"
Jane Seymour says.
"Is the king watching?"
"He is proud of her."
He speaks to Anne, stretched out on her catafalque.
"He says you never looked more beautiful. He sends you this."
Anne makes a little sound, a moan, poised between gratitude and boredom. "Oh, what? Another diamond?"
"And a kiss, which I said he had better bring in person."
She shows no sign of taking the ring from him. 'Tis almost irresistible to place it on her belly and walk away. Instead, he hands it to her sister. He says,
"The feast will wait for you, Highness. Come only when you feel ready."
She leaves herself upright with a gasp.
"I'm coming now."
Mary Howard leans forward and rubs her lower back with an unpracticed hand, a fluttering virginal motion as if she were stroking a bird.
"Oh, get away,"
the anointed queen snaps. She looks sick.
"Where were you last evening? I wanted you. The streets cheered for me. I heard them. They say the people love Catherine, but really, it is just the women. They pity her. We will show them something better. They will love me when this creature is out of me."
Jane Rochford says,
"Oh, but madam, they love Catherine because she is the daughter of two anointed sovereigns. Make your mind up to it, madam. They will never love you any more than they love Cromwell here. It has nothing to do with your merits. It is a point of fact. There is no use trying to evade it."
"Perhaps enough," Jane Seymour says. He turns to her and sees something surprising. She has grown up.
"Lady Carey," Jane Rochford says, "we must get your sister on her feet now and back in her robes. So, see Master Cromwell out and enjoy your usual confabulation. This is not a day to break with tradition."
At the door,
"Mary," he says, notices the dark stains under her eyes.
"Yes?"
She speaks in a tone of yes, and what is it now?
"I am sorry the marriage with my nephew did not come off."
"Not that I was ever asked, of course," she smiles tightly. "I shall never see your house. And one hears so much of it."
"What do you hear?"
"Oh, of chests bursting with gold pieces."
"We would never allow that.
we will get bigger chests. They say it's the king's money.